We'll hear argument this morning in 05983, Winkleman versus Parma City School District. Mr. Andre?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case asks the Court to decide to what extent non-lawyer parents of a child with a disability may litigate an IDEA case pro se in federal court. Under two distinct theories, the answer to that question should be without limitation. But I'd like to focus today on petitioner's primary and first theory, which is that parents are real parties in interest in IDEA suits, regardless of the claims being asserted. Under 28 U.S.C. 1654, a party has a right, as a matter of federal statutory law, to litigate their own case. Accordingly, when a parent sues under IDEA, it's our position that they are suing in their own right and are suing on their own case. This is particularly so because the right to sue provision that Congress enacted in IDEA uses the broad phrase, any party aggrieved, when it allows judicial review of an adverse administrative hearing officer's decision. The parties agree that it is the underlying administrative complaint or the due process complaint that frames both the claims that can be brought eventually in court and also identifies who the parties are that can appear in court. Those complaint provisions in IDEA, and there are eight of them in all, we cite them in footnote 7 of our reply brief, all eight of those provisions refer unambiguously to the parent's complaint. Congress did not describe this due process complaint that starts the whole dispute resolution process as the child's complaint by and through the parents, or the parent's complaint on behalf of the child. Accordingly, when a parent files that due process complaint, they are the real party in interest, and again, the provisions make no distinctions about the kinds of claims that can be brought. It shouldn't matter that when they get to federal court, there shouldn't be any limitation on who is the real party in interest in federal court or what claims may be asserted.
If we say that the parents are the real party in interest and are entitled to sue in their own right, is that the end of the case, or do we reach the second question is whether or not they can represent the children?
I don't think you would need to reach the second question, Justice Kennedy. It's our position that the remedies in an IDEA case are coextensive and that the rights are inseparable. And so this case was pleaded in such a way as to have both the parents and the child be before the court. But if this court were to agree with us on our first and primary theory, we don't believe it would be necessary to have the child listed as a plaintiff to a future suit. And we imagine that on remand, the child might be dismissed from the suit. It's our position that he's not an indispensable party.
What can the parents get out of this case other than reimbursement for tuition they've paid to private schools and procedural rights that are given them by the Act? What can they get out of this case other than those two things that do not depend upon their status as representatives of the child?
Well, clearly the relief primarily sought by my clients. In fact, if you look just at the relief section of the complaint that my clients filed, and this is in Joint Appendix page 19, the only relief they actually seek is reimbursement. There's a number of ways.
What other possible relief could they seek other than giving them a procedural right accorded by the Act? What other possible relief could they seek that they would not be seeking as guardians of the child?
Well, of course, it's our position that parents are never acting as guardians, at least in the legal sense, or lay representatives of a child in a court action. And so, therefore, a parent should be able to assert any one of a claim asserting violations of any one of the many rights conferred in the Act.
It depends upon their being a party aggrieved. That is defined in Black's Law Dictionary.
Correct.
As a party entitled to a remedy.
Correct.
Now, if the only remedies the parents are entitled to in their own right are reimbursement, which is at issue here, and procedural guarantees, why would not their ability to sue or to appear pro se be limited to those two categories? You'd win this case, but I'm talking about how broad is the rule that you're urging us to adopt.
Sure. Well, and in Again, this could be a very easy case if the court wants to look just at the specific procedural violations that my clients assert and also the reimbursement claim that they assert. But it's, of course, our position also that the full bundle of rights can be asserted by parents. And I think maybe the best way to answer your question, Justice Scalia, is that to direct you back to the definition of a free, appropriate public education itself, and that's in 1401 sub 9 and sub 29 in the statute. That definition provides that a free appropriate public education is one that is provided at no cost to parents. So if a school district provides a free and inappropriate public education, then it's the parents' obligation, or it's not obligation, they have the choice of whether to supplement the inappropriate public education with additional services or to replace the public education with one that provides an appropriate bundle of services. So I guess my point is that even in a case where the parents don't necessarily seek reimbursement, they still are intended beneficiaries of the right to a free, appropriate education.
The child is. The child's entitled to an appropriate public education, and the parents are entitled to have it provided free. That's really the only interest they have on the table, it seems to me, separate and apart from their status as representatives or guardians of the child.
Well, we also believe that the parents have an interest in the education being appropriate for, in addition to the reason I just explained, that they may have to supplement an inappropriate education. But parents are also the co-architects of the individualized educational program that is eventually that defines the bundle of services that are provided to the child. And they're integral to the
process. You say they're the co-architects. I mean, are you saying anything more than they're given a procedural right to participate in the hearing?
I think they're given, I haven't counted them, but I think they're given 10, 12 of the 15 procedural rights outlined in the statute. And as this Court explained in Rowley, Congress placed every bit as much emphasis on parental involvement in the shaping of the individualized educational program as it did upon.
But isn't there a bit of, there's a leap from saying they have these various procedural rights and they're a party aggrieved by the decision rendered after the hearing. That's a different question, isn't it?
Well, typically a parent would file a due process complaint, again, challenging the bundle of services offered by the school district and alleging a procedural violation. And so I think it would be a rare case where a parent would, by the time they get to federal court, try to be a party aggrieved to something that they didn't exhaust below. I mean, that would render the exhaustion requirement.
They are an aggrieved party for purposes of the administrative process. The question is, when that is done, whether they also constitute an aggrieved party. And one of the points made by the other side is that there's an express provision for proceeding without counsel at the administrative level, and there's no provision for proceeding without counsel in court. So doesn't that suggest that the right to proceed pro se is limited to the administrative process?
No, not at all, Justice Ginsburg. Congress sensibly recognized that because due process proceedings are run on a state-by-state basis, certain unauthorized practice of law statutes or other laws prohibiting counsel in administrative proceedings might come into play. So Congress had to make it express in Section 1415H1 that any party may appear in the administrative proceedings with or without counsel. In contrast, in federal court, there's already 28 U.S.C. 1654, which has been on the books since 1789 as part of the Judiciary Act. That provision allows any party to litigate their own case. So it actually makes a lot of sense that Congress would have included the express right to proceed pro se.
That just begs the question, doesn't it? I mean, you're assuming that the parents are a party to the case in federal court.
Well, it's our position that they are because their parties aggrieved by the administrative proceedings so long as they have exhausted their claims. And that this is confirmed in other provisions. For example, the attorney's fees provision of the statute refers repeatedly to parents as a possible prevailing party.
I thought it was the unanimous view of the circuits that parents, as a general matter, do not have the right to represent their children in federal court, that the provision of the judicial code that you cited does not confer on parents generally the right to represent children.
Oh, that's absolutely correct, Mr. Chief Justice. But our primary theory in this case is not that parents are seeking to represent their children as lay advocates in court. Our primary theory is that a parent suing under this statute is suing in their own right. In fact, that's why my clients pleaded this case with themselves on the caption and asserted claims that are their own, because they believe that those claims are their own, and they believe that they should be able to litigate those claims under Section 1654.
You know, it's not an insignificant matter at issue here. Counsel who are referred to as officers of the court protect the court from frivolous suits, from suits that that really have no basis. When we give that authority to appear in court and initiate a suit to the public at large, we make a lot more work for federal district judges. Why should we interpret this statute to achieve that unusual result?
Well, I'm not sure that the policy considerations would be relevant to the statutory construction question of whose rights are being asserted in a case like this. But certainly under our second theory, you know, the public policy considerations would be appropriate. It's our position that those public policy concerns about pro se litigants burdening the courts, burdening opposing counsel, are dramatically outweighed by the fact that, or by the reality, that two-thirds of the disabled children in the United States come from families that cannot afford counsel.
But the statute already allows the shifting of fees to a prevailing party. Right. So presumably attorneys can be found to take the meritorious cases, and what we're probably dealing with are cases that can't attract attorneys, even though the attorneys know that if they win, they will get their fees.
I have two responses, Mr. Chief Justice. First, in other regimes where you have a fee-shifting statute, the cases are usually still brought by pro se litigants. Here, because you're dealing with a minor child, really it's an all-or-nothing proposition. Either bring the case and you have the potential to recover attorney's fees, or the case doesn't get brought at all. And this is borne out by the statistics cited in our petition and the amicus briefs from the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates and the Autism Society of America.
Was there an argument at any point in this case that the claim is frivolous?
No, there was not. And that brings me to, I guess, my last point, which is, as a practical matter, there's a very limited private special ed bar, and they cherry-pick only the best cases, but that doesn't mean that all the cases that are left are frivolous or meritless. There's a whole universe of cases out there, some which may be quite strong, some which may be on the borderline, and some which may be meritless, but Congress could not have intended to create this important and robust substantive statutory guarantee to a free appropriate public education and guaranteed all these procedural safeguards, including judicial review, to enforce it, and then expected that right would never be fulfilled because —
Well, if they had that overriding intent, it would have been easy enough for them to make clear that this was an exception to the normal rule that parents don't have the right to represent children in court. They did that with respect to the administrative proceeding. As Justice Ginsburg pointed out, they perhaps conspicuously did not do it with respect to the proceeding in court.
Well, actually, if I could clarify one thing, if you look closely at Section 1415H1, it does not provide that a parent can represent their child in the administrative proceeding. It just says that any party may litigate that administrative proceeding with
a counsel. No, but 1415F specifically says that parents have the right to participate in the due process hearing. I'm looking at 1415F1A. In other words, that parents have the right to participate in the due process hearing.
Right, but that's also it's our position that they have the right to participate in due process hearing as parties. In fact, as the kind of plaintiff side parties, and that's confirmed by the eight provisions that we cite in footnote 7 of our reply brief that talk about the parent's complaint.
Well, it doesn't say they have the right to participate as parties. They say they have the right to. For an impartial due process hearing. I would suppose if you're trying to figure out who's the party to that case, you would still think of it in terms of the child and not the parents.
Well, we believe that Congress thought of it as the parents because of all the statutory references to the parent's complaint. Of course, we don't take the absurd position that the child could not also be a party to those proceedings. But in any event, my point was simply that the expressio unius argument that some courts have relied on to suggest that Congress consciously decided not to allow parental lay representation. That argument simply, it doesn't have a strong foundation because the provision on which that argument is based, which is 1415H1, is just, it's ambiguous at best and in fact could suggest just the opposite. I'd like to address a point that respondents have relied on, which
well,
I think
before,
also.
Before you do that, how much of a practical benefit would it be if for children with disabilities and their parents, if you're successful here, in light of the complexity of the IDEA and the fact that this is an area where some parents are going to have difficulty maintaining any kind of emotional detachment from the litigation, if parents can represent their — can non-lawyer parents can appear in court, isn't there a risk that in some instances where a lawyer could be found, if the parent made an effort to do that, they're going to be lured into trying to provide the representation themselves?
Well, first of all, parents already have to get to know the statute and the applicable regulations when they bring these cases at the administrative level. So by the time they get to court, they're intimately familiar with the facts, intimately familiar with the relevant law. The only thing that's different about a court action and the administrative proceeding is that now you have the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
These disadvantaged parents that you were referring to who comprise the majority of parents? They're really up on Section K, you know, H1 and all that stuff. I find that hard to believe. I mean, the people you're assertedly benefiting here are the people least likely to have familiarized themselves with the statute and the procedures.
Well, I'm not sure we agree with all due respect to Justice Scalia, but even if that's true, the nature of IDEA court actions, I think, addresses some of the concern. These are not pure record review proceedings like in Merit Systems Protection Board cases or immigration cases, but they are quasi-review proceedings. And so what we're advocating here is really access to the courts. Let the parents, whether they are brilliant writers or whether they're not so good at writing, let them at least have access to the courts. That way, then, the capable district judge can look at the case and decide whether the school district has complied with the statutory mandates.
You can do it right after reading pro se prisoner petitions, right? You'd have a nice evening's work.
Well, we think that the pro se parents are quite different from pro se prisoners. But I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Andre. Mr. Salmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Congress made parents of children with disabilities parties in their own right in administrative and judicial proceedings under the IDEA and granted parents their own rights under the Act. One of the rights granted expressly to parents is the right to seek reimbursement for private educational expenses when the parents believe the school has failed to provide an appropriate education. That is the claim that's at issue in this case, and the parents are clearly the appropriate party for that claim because they're the ones that have incurred the financial harm. When their reimbursement claim —
I mean, that argument proves a little too much. If you have a child who is the victim of a tort, for example, and suffers a serious injury, it's the parents who are going to have to bear the costs of accommodating that injury. And yet, in any tort action, it's still the child who is the party and not the parent.
Well, that may be — I think that's right, Your Honor, but the difference here is that the statute in Section 1412A10C2, and this is on page 6A of Petitioner's brief, expressly provides a right to parents to seek reimbursement for their educational expenses that they incur. And while the parents have to show that there was a denial of a free, appropriate public education, we think it's clear that the statute makes the claim, the parent's claim. And there are cases, for example, out of the Fourth Circuit in Emory, that would suggest that it's not even clear that the child would have standing to assert a claim for reimbursement when they're not out of pocket any expenses. So we think in a case like this, this is an easy case. We think clearly here the parents are the parties.
But that, then you would be establishing a right for the least needy. I mean, if they're seeking reimbursement, they're able to pay the private school tuition. It's the people who can't, who have no alternative. They have to take what the school district gives them because they don't have the wherewithal to enroll their child in a private school. And your argument, concentrating on the reimbursement right, would leave out those people, would it not?
Well, that's not the sum total of our argument, Your Honor. I was just pointing out that actually there's a relatively narrow way to decide this case if the court so chose by focusing on the reimbursement claim in this case. Our position is that parents share in the substantive right to a free, appropriate public education under the Act, and there are two things we would point to in regards to the definition of a free, appropriate public education that we think makes this clear, and this is in Section 1401 of the Act on pages 2A and 4A of petitioner's brief. The first is the definition says that the term free appropriate public education means special education services provided, quote, without charge and at no cost to parents. We think clearly the free aspect, again, is first and foremost the right of the parents, since they're the ones that bear the cost. With regard to
— I'm not following you. Where is this provision? 1401 what?
I think you quoted from 4A.
That's correct. The definition begins on page 2A, okay. Which says free appropriate public education
right.
on section 1401, and it says the term free appropriate public education means special education and related services that, and then under subparagraph A, have been provided at public expense, under public supervision and direction, and without charge. And then in subparagraph 29, which is on page 4A, the term special education is defined, which is, again, the term from the definition of free appropriate public education, is defined to mean specially designed instructions at no cost to parents. And so, again, the right to a free appropriate public education is defined expressly, in part, as terms of the parents' interest. We also think that with regard to any question about what is the appropriate education for the child, if you look back again on 2A, subparagraph D of the definition of free appropriate public education says that it has to be special education services that are provided in conformity with the individual education program required under the Act. And now the individual education program, or IEP process, is the process by which parents are given the right to participate as full members of the IEP team and to have a say in helping to define what is an appropriate education for their child. And as this Court pointed out in Rowley, this is the essential feature of this Act. The way it works is that Congress did not specify or flesh out a substantive standard for what is appropriate for a child. Instead, it mandated that an appropriate education is an education that involves parental involvement. And when there is a dispute with regard to whether the IEP team has adopted the right educational program for the child, we think that the Act makes parents, who are full members of that team, when their views are rejected as far as what is appropriate, they are given the procedural safeguard of initiating a due process hearing. Again, the Act
their right to proceed in federal court should be limited to the rights that you've identified under the statute, as opposed to the right to proceed on behalf of the child.
That's correct.
The rights they can assert are only ones they can identify as their own, as opposed to the child's.
Well, that is essentially our position, although I would add that our position is that all of the rights of the statute are rights that are shared by the parent,
at least with regard to the substantive right. I thought you were saying that they can sue for the money and they can sue for denied procedures. But if all the procedures are given and they're still not satisfied with the public education that is given, they would not be able to sue, claiming that it was inadequate under the terms of the Act. You think they can sue then, too, as well?
Yes, Your Honor,
do. You haven't said anything, then.
Well,
you really haven't limited the scope of the parent's right to sue at all.
Well, just because I haven't limited the scope of the parent's right doesn't mean that I haven't been trying to make a point about how to interpret the statute. The statute, we think, does not limit the parent's rights to sue on behalf of their child and on behalf of their own rights under the statute. We think the way to think about this, again, keep in mind that the right to initiate a due process hearing and the right to seek review of that in court, those are rights that are contained in Section 1415, which is the procedural protections, the procedural guarantees of the Act. And we think that those are rights that belong to the parent.
That's fine. You give them the procedure, but where does the Act guarantee the parents the proper outcome, the proper assignment?
Well, we think
it does give the parents the right procedures explicitly, and the right to reimbursement for private tuition.
That's correct. The way we would look at the question, Your Honor, is to say it gives the parents those rights. It gives the parents the right to be full members of the IEP team that determines the appropriate education for that child. While the school district has the final say as far as the contents of the IEP, the parents, as members of that team, have the right to initiate litigation through administrative procedures and then ultimately in court if their view of what is appropriate for their child is rejected by the IEP team. And
where is that right contained? You've given us citations for the other ones. Where is that right? The right to initiate a suit solely on the basis, not that I was denied procedures, not that I paid money for private schooling, but I do not believe the outcome, the education given to my child in the public school, was enough.
Your Honor, what I would refer you to are the many provisions of the Act, and you can turn to pages 16A and 17A, for example, a petitioner's brief that has these in part, where the Act repeatedly refers to the parent's due process complaint, the parent's due process complaint notice, the parent's right to a due process hearing. The 2004 amendments expressly referred to and defined prevailing party to be parents. It referred to the parents'
right,
cause of action.
They have the right to the hearing, but do they,
well,
have,
they
the
have
right,
a right?
Do they have a right in and of themselves, not as guardians? Do they have the right to a particular outcome in the hearing? That's the point I'm
requiring. Our way of looking at the statute, Your Honor, says that if they are the ones that initiate the hearing, they file the complaint, they're parties to that hearing, then when their claims are denied, they are parties aggrieved within the meaning of the statute. It's the same term, parties aggrieved, that refers to the right to an appeal in the administrative process that refers to the ability to initiate a
sure,
civil cause of action.
It's not just party aggrieved. It's party aggrieved by the findings and decision, as opposed to party aggrieved by a denial of a procedural right, and those strike me as two different things.
Well, it does reference back. In fact, it references back to the complaint that's filed to initiate the due process hearing, and the parties are the ones that, the parents are the ones that are referred to as the ones filing those complaints. It's referred to repeatedly as the parents' complaint, and the parents are referred to as prevailing parties in the civil action. Again, in the attorney's fees provisions that were added in 2004 expressly refer to, quote, the parents' complaint or subsequent cause of action. This is on page 24A of petitioner's brief. And it refers to parents as a prevailing party. There are other provisions that do so as well. And while we're on the topic of the 2004 amendments, I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Selmans. Mr. Bergeron?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The common law rule banning parental pro se representation is as longstanding as it is pervasive. Appreciating the fact that the IDA does not abrogate the common law rule, petitioners instead seek to circumvent that through the substantive rights theory. Yet their due process complaint never raised any issue of parental substantive rights, nor even did their cert petition, which at page 11 said children have substantive rights, but parents have procedural rights. Now, however, they tell this Court that the parents' substantive right is so ingrained in the fabric of the statute that the Court should recognize it.
How do you classify a right to reimbursement?
Your Honor, I would classify that as not a right, it's a remedy. It is a remedy premised on the denial of the FAPE to the child. And as a result, it's simply a derivative claim for the parents to recover those funds.
The right to recover money is just a remedy, it's not a right.
That's how 1412 is structured, the provisions about reimbursement. It depends on the predicate finding that the child was denied a FAPE, and therefore one of the remedies, among other remedies, compensatory education and so forth, is reimbursement.
What about the provision that says at no cost to the parent?
Your Honor, certainly that has been one of the emphasis by petitioners, but the response to that is the free aspect of the free appropriate public education does not give parents a substantive right to the education itself. We are debating in this case, the merits of this case, we are debating the A aspect, the appropriateness. We are not saying we have not expelled the student and therefore they have a claim based on that.
Can I just go back to my other question to be sure I got your point? The reimbursement is paid to whom?
Your Honor,
the child or the parents?
Our position is it would be paid to the child. The child would be the party that could bring that claim. And I just would like to clarify, if you look at page 153 of the
joint appendix. You reimburse a child for money that his parents spent.
And, Your Honor, that is how the courts, the lower courts in the Third Circuit, where the Collins Group rule prevails, that's how they apply it.
What would happen if the child were deceased or incompetent?
Well, that is exactly the scenario in the Seventh Circuit case that they cited from 2007, and they said it's the child's estate is the one that brings the claim. Now, in that case, the child had actually expended the funds, but that case upheld the rule that we were advocating here.
In an instance in which the money is paid to the reimbursement is paid to the child, how does the child get the money to the parents?
Your Honor, we assume that
maybe these children don't. Do they set up trust funds for these reimbursements?
Your Honor, I think it's no different than a basic attorney fee award. There's not a claim that you know, if someone else, if the uncle pays the attorney's fees, that doesn't negate the award of fees on behalf of the child.
No, I'm not talking about negating the award. If that theory is sound, that the child is the proper recipient of the reimbursement, I presume that ultimately the reimbursement is supposed to go to the person who paid the money,
which
would be the parent. My question is, how does the child in that case get the money to the parent?
Well, because the claim would have to be brought on behalf of the child because they would not have capacity to bring the claim itself, the award would go straight to the guardian, who may be the parent that's proceeding on their behalf.
Yeah, but the guardian can't take the funds that belong to a child.
Well, but, Your Honor, we believe that that's the pragmatic result that Congress intended here.
All right, but if the guardian is in a position to convey the money to himself in the different capacity as the parent, then why isn't the guardian equally in a position to be substituted for the child in litigating the action?
Well, Your Honor,
you can't have it both ways.
Well, the guardian could certainly bring the claim on behalf of the child, but it's different than bringing the claim in their own right. And I would point out that at page 153 of the Joint Appendix, it specifies that at the administrative hearing level, there was no claim for reimbursement to the parents. In fact, what they were seeking was reimbursement to Monarch, to the school. In other words, as far as the administrative record disclosed, they had not actually paid the funds.
What is this to do? I mean, I'm puzzled about why we're talking about this complicated thing. I mean, the statute, as I read it, has a section, and it's called procedural rights.
Yes.
And it says that the procedural rights right at the beginning are for both the children and the parents. And it sets up some procedures in the agency, which is for the children and the parents and the school board, and everybody's supposed to be there. And then another part of the same section says any person aggrieved by the first has a court hearing. Why isn't that the end of it? It's clearly aimed, as the statute's aimed, at both students and parents. And then we give them all procedural rights. And what in the statute says that the procedures that they're following before the school board happen to be for both parents and students? But without saying a word, a different procedure, a federal court procedure in the same section, without saying anything, would be just for the students and not for the parents. I mean, I find that hard to read the statute that way.
Well, Your Honor, if you're talking about the distinction between the procedural and the substance in the Act, Congress made clear.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about the whole Act. Throughout the whole Act, they talk about parents and students.
Right.
And who writes the check? The student?
Generally, no, Your
Honor. No, of course. The parent writes the check. And who has the interest? I have an interest in educating my children, as you do in yours. And this statute talks about that throughout. So I'm looking at the particular words in the procedural section, and the particular words explicitly say that every subsection is both for parents or child. And then we get to the court one, and it talks about person aggrieved. And you, I guess, have to convince me, which, as I'm putting it, sounds like an uphill battle. But you have to convince me that that word person aggrieved, appearing at the end of this section, is meant to apply to only some of the people whom every other section talks about, namely just children, not parents. Now, why should I read it that way?
Let me try to explain, Justice Breyer. The reason is, as petitioners effectively concede in their reply brief, party aggrieved does depend on the party entitled to the remedy. And if we look at the amendment in 1415F3E, which was just added in 2004, it clarifies that all relief that the hearing officer should award is based on substantive violation to the child. And it's important that if we look through the entirety of subchapter 2, there are more than two dozen references to the right, to the obligation, to the provision of a FAPE to the child. That is what we are talking about. The dispute resolution provisions hinge on vindicating the child's right. And I think the question earlier to Mr. Salmons was —
What's that section you just alluded to? You're blasting by it. Where is it in the —
I'm sorry, which section?
1415.
Oh, 1415F3E is located on 21A of the blue brief, Your Honor. And what that section —
21A or
— 21A of the blue brief, Your Honor.
And which is the statutory section again?
It's 1415F3E.
I thought you said 1415.
Are you sure it's not 18A?
F3E is on 18A.
F3E is on it's on 21A of my version of the blue brief, Your Honor. That's the provision. It's called — it's titled Decision of a Hearing Officer. And it provides the hearing officer should grant relief on substantive grounds.
It's an 18A of
— It's 18A of mine, too. Maybe you have a different brief there.
It's not my brief, Your Honor. I apologize. In any event, it limits the hearing officer's ability to award relief based on the substantive — whether the substantive right to the FAPE has been awarded or not. And then we return to Justice Breyer's point about the party aggrieved. The party aggrieved by the finding or the decision. Because the decision is limited to substantive grounds, that is what we're really talking about here. And I think one of the confusing aspects about what the nature of this substantive right is, I think we've heard some different versions of that this morning, is what is the scope? Petitioners in their reply brief seem to try to retreat a little bit and make the right more palatable. But if they, in doing so, the question is, what is the right different than the child's right? And we simply do not have the answer for that. And for the school districts applying this act on a daily basis and for courts interpreting it, it simply poses numerous problems trying to apply to a parent a statute that was designed to benefit children.
Your argument, I guess with this argument now you're conceding, the parent does have a right to go to court, but he can only complain about something that hurts him.
I would not.
He can't complain in court. All right. Well, it sounded as if you were saying that. You were saying that the hearing officer has to decide against the parent. And if he doesn't decide against the parent, obviously the parent can't go into court because he doesn't have anything to complain about the parent. Isn't that your point?
He can't decide against the parent because the only issue at stake is the right of the child.
I'm sorry, then. You go ahead. I thought I heard you say that the problem is that the parent didn't have a right taken away by the hearing officer, and that's why the parent can't go to court.
Well, he won't have a right taken away from him because it's not his claims at stake in the due process here.
Oh, I agree. We can be on the same ground there.
Right.
I agree that if the parent isn't hurt, because the parent wasn't deprived of anything, the parent can go to court but doesn't have anything to complain about. But, of course, another section of the statute says that reimbursement is something supposed to be reimbursement for the parent. So it would seem as if the parent has something to complain about.
Isn't that so? It says a parent is to be reimbursed. I thought that was one of the things.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's what it says.
So now it looks as if the parent has something to complain about. The parent hasn't got the money that he was supposed to get. So now we have something to complain about, so therefore we're aggrieved. And then the last section says an aggrieved person can go to court.
Right. And we simply feel that because the reimbursement, as I've said before, hinges on the deprivation of the right to the child and not the deprivation of the substantive right to the parent, it is the child's claim to bring.
Mr. Bergeron, I have a basic conceptual problem both with that response and with your larger argument.
Leaving aside how we should classify the reimbursement right or classify reimbursement, you make a broad distinction between the substantive right of the child to the free appropriate public education, and on the other hand, the procedural rights of the parents in going through the process that ultimately comes to a conclusion for the child's benefit. The conceptual problem I have is that I don't understand why it makes sense to say that the parents have procedural rights unless those procedural rights of the parents are in aid of some substantive entitlement of the parents. We give procedural protection to people in order to vindicate some substantive interest that they can claim. And you're, in effect, splitting those two apart. You're saying one person has a substantive right, the other people have procedural rights. And I don't see conceptually how you can make that split. And if you don't make that split, then it only makes sense to say that the right to the free public, the free appropriate public education is, as the statute in one place seems to say, a right of the family group, the parents and the child together, rather than the right of the child alone. So conceptually, how do you defend the distinction that you make between substantive rights on one person, procedural rights in another?
And here's how I would explain it, Justice Souter. The right, the substantive right, is the right to the FAPE, to the child. And because the child does not have capacity, Congress implemented a pragmatic system to allow the parents to protect those rights. It's derivative for the parent to protect the child's
rights. Then why don't we say that they are the procedural rights of the child and the parents are simply stepping into the child's shoes to vindicate
them? That is exactly what 1415M says, Your Honor. That allows the transfer of rights. In 1415M, is it 11A and 12A of the red brief? And I hope I've got the cite right this time. 1415M allows for states to require, and Ohio does, to require the transfer of all rights under subchapter 2 that a parent would otherwise have straight to the child. So basically
when the child reaches majority.
That's
the
right.
The child is no longer a child. The child is an adult.
And that's part of
and,
what
and
I was
that
trying
is,
to say.
I'm sorry, you go ahead.
What I'm trying to say is because the child lacks capacity, they can't do all these things on their own until they reach majority. But once they do, and the rights transfer, it illustrates that it's not really the parents' right. It is the child's right that they are protecting.
But what stands in the way of that analysis is the text, which says all other rights accorded to parents under this subchapter transfer to the child. Not only doesn't that help you, it seems to me it hurts you. It acknowledges that there are rights accorded to parents.
Right, and those would be the procedural safeguards that are delineated in the Act.
But then you were denying them, as I understood your argument.
Well, let me clarify then. I wasn't denying the existence of the procedural safeguards. To the contrary, what I'm saying is that they are not redressable independent of themselves in federal court unless and this is what 1415F3E clarifies, is that you have to have a substantive violation because if you think of a situation in which the child is provided a FAPE. No one disputes that. But the parent says, well, you didn't invite me to a meeting. What's your remedy there? There is no remedy. And that's what Congress was trying to
clarify. But isn't that the problem? On the analysis that you're coming up with, the parents end up without even the procedural rights. Because you're saying the only person who can basically invoke a violation of procedural right is the person who has been denied the substantive right. The parent hasn't been denied the substantive right. Therefore, the parent cannot invoke even the procedural right, which ostensibly, on your own analysis, the parent has been given. That can't be correct.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at it, I'll direct you to the DiBuio case and the Lesany case. I'm probably mispronouncing
both. No, but before you direct the cases, what's wrong with the analytical point that I just made?
Well, Your Honor, that's what Congress was trying to clarify in 2004. They did not want technical procedural violations to eclipse the substantive right. And so what they provided was the substantive right is the only one that is enforced.
Yeah, but instead of saying they're not eclipsed, you're saying that they are totally blocked out. Because your analysis, I thought, was In response to my earlier objection, that the procedural right, in fact, can only ultimately be invoked for the vindication of the substantive right. And because the substantive right is the child's, not the parent's, it would follow that the parents cannot even invoke their procedural rights. And we know that that can't be correct.
Right, and I'm not saying that the parent's procedural rights are gone. I mean, remember,
but if the parent's procedural rights are not gone, then the parents must be able to invoke those procedural rights based on what they claim to be a denial of some substantive entitlement. And you're saying that's the entitlement of the child. But if the parents are going to have any procedural right worth having, they've got to invoke it for the purpose of vindicating that substantive right. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Then why do not the parents, when they are claiming that they are aggrieved, have as much right to make a claim that goes to the substantive denial as to the procedural denial, simply because the two are inseparable?
Your Honor, because that, again, that was what Congress was trying to clarify in 2004. And if you look at the DiBuio case and the Lesney case, cited on page 27 of the SG's brief, both those cases make clear that notwithstanding procedural violations, there must actually be a causation. There must actually be substantive harm before any relief can flow from
it. Does a parent have a right to bring a 1983 action if their procedural rights under this statute are interfered with by the state actors?
Your Honor, if the parent would otherwise have a 1983 claim, under 1415L, if it relates to an IDEA claim, there would have to be exhaustion first.
I think I understand your argument based on 3E, but when I look at page 21A of my blue brief, there's another provision on attorney's fees, and it's phrased in a very curious way. It says that fees are allowed to a prevailing party who is the parent of a child with a disability. It seems to me that's the most difficult express language for you to deal with. It doesn't say attorney's fees happen to be allowed to parents. It's to a prevailing party who is a parent, and I understand your argument to be that a parent can never be a prevailing party.
That's right, and let me try to explain why. If you look at 1411E3E, which is 5A of the red brief, and I started to keep jumping briefs on you, that provides that litigation brought to secure the right of the child to a FAPE is brought on behalf of the child. So Congress added both that section and the section you were just referring to at the same time. And the only way to read them harmoniously is that any action is being brought on behalf of the child to secure the FAPE. It's not the parent's own action that they are bringing. They are bringing it on their own, on behalf of the child.
What was the section you cited?
1411E3E on 5A of the red brief.
E3E,
yes.
Legal fees. The disbursements under subparagraph D shall not support legal fees, court costs, or other costs associated with a cause of action brought on behalf of a child with a disability to ensure a free, appropriate public education for such child. Now, what do you think that proves?
What I'm saying is Congress recognized that when legal action is being brought to secure a FAPE, just like it's the child's right to the FAPE under subchapter 2, it is being brought on behalf of the child. And that's where petitioners run into problem with the common law rule, because the common law rule, as they don't dispute, is that parents cannot bring claims on behalf of the child pro se. So they have to find a way to abrogate. And they initially argued in the opening brief for an exception to the common law rule, which it, from my reading of the reply brief, they've abandoned. So the core issue in dispute as far as the petitioners go is what is the nature of this substantive right? And I'd like to make —
It says the section you pointed to says the disbursements under subparagraph D, but your brief doesn't include subparagraph D.
It's the high cost, one of the high cost funds for states, Justice Ginsburg. And I'd like to make —
Well, then, if this provision is limited to subparagraph D, how can you argue that it covers the waterfront?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's indicative of what Congress appreciated the claim would look like on any level. And it's not simply saying that those funds aren't provided under subparagraph D. That is the nature of the claim, regardless of under what section we're looking at. That is the nature of the claim that would be brought in order to secure a FAPE for the child. And in every circumstance, it is brought on behalf of the child. Your Honor, I'd like to make one point, if I can, about the spending clause in response to petitioner's argument in the reply brief. Petitioners effectively say that the spending clause doesn't apply because this is not an issue of liability. I'd like to direct your attention again to Rowley, where footnotes 11 and 26, the Court recognized the difference between the educational benefit, which is the FAPE, and maximize the educational outcome.
Are attorney's fees allowed to a parent who is bringing one of these cases on behalf of a child pro se?
No.
Convoluted question. Okay. So there's no issue under the spending clause that a non-attorney parent would be able to claim some sort of attorney's fees?
That's what — I think there have been four circuits to address that in the context of attorney parents, and they've all said that they cannot get fees.
So how is the spending clause issue very significant in terms of the exposure of the school boards?
Well, Arlington did not limit it to simply liability issues. It said repeatedly obligations and conditions. And that's exactly what Rowley was looking at in footnotes 11 and 26. We don't necessarily have to have a line item that there's going to be X dollars in damage. It was simply the difference between an educational benefit and maximizing that benefit that triggered spending clause concerns in Rowley. Just like in South Dakota v. Dole, the issue of whether someone was 21 in order to consume alcohol was not necessarily a liability, but it was a very important obligation or condition imposed upon the states. And their second point regarding the spending clause is that not every single detail needs to be fleshed out in clear notice.
So I take it your argument is, your red brief argument is that Congress said, states, if you get some judgments against you and they award attorney's fees, you pay for it, we won't. Is that what it says?
No.
You won't pay for it. You can't pay for it out of the grant.
Right.
Okay. So we're not paying for this. You pay for it. Is that right?
I'm sorry.
Don't pay for states.
Right.
Some people bring some claims against you under this because you didn't have a good plan for the child, and your attorney's fees are awarded against you. Don't pay for it out of this grant. Isn't that what you're saying it says?
Well, Your Honor, it's a little bit different because part of the real issue here is not necessarily an award of attorney's fees to the other party, but it's the incurrence of attorney's fees defending the
person. I thought what your argument was, and if it's not, forget it. It's just that I don't understand it. That here the government says, pay for this out of your own pocket. And then it defines what you're supposed to pay out of your own pocket is as a parent representing a child, not his own action. And then later on they say, they define it differently. They talk about prevailing party, the parents of a prevailing party. But, you say, that second phrase must mean the first phrase, because it wouldn't make sense for the government to say, pay for that out of the grant, but not this out of the grant.
And
is that your argument?
I think that's right.
Okay. It's an argument.
Just to clarify, Congress isn't providing any funds for this. I mean, they recognized in 2004 they were only funding 19% of the obligations of the statute, and we have to pick up the balance of the tab. And their other argument on the spending clause is that it's you don't have to flesh out everything in the statute, but here we're talking about two core issues. One is abrogating the common law rule, and the other is the creation of substantive rights to an entirely new class of beneficiaries. If there's ever anything that demanded clear notice, this is it. It is much more serious and severe than the expert fees at issue in Arlington, and school districts and states simply have to have notice. What is the parameter of the right that you're being requested to recognize? And based on the briefing and based on what we've heard at argument, it's simply not clear to the school districts not only what the nature of the right is, but how to apply it.
Well, that's where I have a little bit of trouble. It's not the underlying right is still the same. It's the right of the child to a free and appropriate public education, and that can be vindicated in court actions by attorneys who get their fees paid if they prevail, and all we're talking about is a situation where the parents can assert that same right when an attorney won't. And I'm just wondering how significant additional exposure we're talking about, and What turns on that is whether to take the spending clause argument seriously or not.
Well, and I think the answer to that is it's still not clear to me from listening to the argument today. I mean, petitioner acknowledged that the child falls out of the equation. This is a statute written to benefit the child, and they're taking the child completely out. And so what is the nature of this parental right? The SG says, well, it's all intertwined. But if we look at what petitioner says,
if we were talking about what is the toll on the state, it seems to me that if the state would have to pay for a lawyer if it lost, and the parent who brings the case is not entitled to reimbursement, how is the state's pocketbook affected?
Justice Ginsburg, in litigating this case, while the Winkelmans were pro se, we expended far greater than the $8,000 at issue in Arlington on our legal fees defending.
Right, but you would have had to do that if they had gotten a lawyer to take the case. What your spending clause argument is, the state agreed to undertake this liability, that they would have to provide a free and appropriate education, and if they litigated, they'd have to pay the other side's attorney's fees. But if they knew that in the case where an attorney wouldn't take it, the parents could prosecute it, and that might result in overturning their decision, and that might result in greater expense. Well, in that case, they would not have bought into this deal at all. That seems a little implausible.
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, remember at the time that the Congress reauthorized in 2004, every circuit that had addressed it besides the first had agreed that parents could not bring it pro se. So the states reasonably would not have believed, especially in the circuits where it was decided, that they would have to come up with these funds.
I'm not disputing that it results in additional exposure. I'm just disputing that it affects the voluntariness of their agreement to undertake the program.
Well, if you in the dissent in Arlington, they made Justice Breyer made a materiality argument, and the majority did not seem moved by it. So I think this is something that's very significant, not simply in the dollars involved, but how we apply this substantive right to parents that the petitioners seek to have recognized.
Could the court appoint the parent guardian ad litem and just let the parent proceed as guardian ad litem?
That wouldn't solve the issue of, under the common law, the guardian ad litem would not have the ability to proceed pro se on the common law piece the same as the parent. The rule is the same. So they would still have
guardian ad litem cannot proceed pro se?
That's right, unless they are an attorney, which in many cases the appointment might be to someone who is an attorney.
Mr. Bergeron, one of the points you made on the spending clause argument, I thought, was that if there are lawyers representing the parents, the lawyers are going to screen out the more frivolous cases.
Right.
If they are not, more frivolous cases are going to be brought.
Right.
And there's an intuitive appeal to that argument. Do we have any figures on the comparative numbers of frivolous cases in lawyer representation and pro se representation under the Act?
Justice Souter, we don't, because most of the circuits were saying we're not going to allow
we don't have
pro
any,
se.
We don't have any First Circuit numbers
no,
versus
we,
other numbers.
We check and we couldn't find anything, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bergeron. Mr. Andre, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I would like to turn briefly to respondents' assertion that petitioners have somehow waived their claim for reimbursement by not exhausting it below. We addressed this in our reply brief, but if the Court wishes to look at pages 78 and 88 of the Joint Appendix, particularly page 78, there it's clear that petitioners were seeking reimbursement in their own right. On the page 153 the respondent refers to, I assume that at that point in time we were now on appeal to the second tier of the Ohio administrative proceeding, and perhaps at that point in time Monarch School was actually paying for Jacob's education on a kind of a grant-like basis, because that was something that happened in this case, and that perhaps at that point in time petitioners referenced reimbursement to Monarch because Monarch had been actually expending the funds. But by and large, it's my clients who expended the funds to educate Jacob at Monarch School, and they certainly did exhaust that claim for reimbursement.
Are you claiming that hiring an attorney would be a cost if the phrase at no cost to the parent? If they have to hire an attorney, that's a cost.
Certainly. I mean, and I think that's why Congress included the attorney's fee provision in 2004 that recognized that parents can be prevailing parties, and if they prevail on establishing that a free or appropriate public education has not been provided, then they can recover attorney's fees as part of their right to try to vindicate Congress's purposes at no cost to them.
So why didn't Congress just add the provision making this very clear that the Senate had passed? Why did the House boot it out of the conference bill?
We don't know. The legislative record is entirely silent. But one plausible inference could be reached based on looking at the addition of the attorney's fees provision and the timing of the Moroney decision in the First Circuit. Moroney came down after the parental lay representation provision was proposed by the Senate. Moroney was the first Court of Appeals case to recognize that parents may litigate these cases pro se. The way Moroney did it, however, was by adopting our primary argument here today, which is that parents possess the right to sue in their own name as pro se litigants, not as lay representatives of their children, and seek to enforce the full bundle of rights. Congress very well could have looked at Moroney and said, aha, that's what we intended all along. Moroney got it right. And then Congress just put its thumb on the scale a little bit by enacting the attorney's fee provision, which made clear that parents can be or are the prevailing party if the plaintiffs prevail in an IDEA action. Finally, I'd like to address two points about the spending clause. Of course, we believe the spending clause is totally inapplicable. But I want to respond to respondent's suggestion that we're advocating creation of a new substantive right here.
Why do you think it's totally inapplicable?
Well, we think that this Court's spending clause jurisprudence is concerned with providing clear notice to states with respect to liability and certain fiscal obligations. And what respondent is complaining about here —
Please.
Oh, what respondent is complaining about here is essentially a disparate impact, and this Court has never recognized a disparate impact claim under the spending clause.
So you think it's not violated, not that it doesn't apply for some reason? Well, I mean, there's no doubt this is spending clause legislation, right?
Oh, absolutely spending clause legislation, but we believe that the clear notice concerns of the spending clause are not even implicated, but that if the clear notice concerns were implicated, the statute is sufficiently clear.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.